We'll do some financial regulation today, some tax policy as well, the fashion industry, and a little bit of Make Me Smart. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 14th of February. Glad as always to have you along, everybody. So, Janet Yellen, remember her? Most powerful economist on the planet? She went up to Capitol Hill today for a couple of days of testimony, talked about financial regulations, real estate, interest rates, of course. Here's the thing about the Fed Board of Governors, though. Federal Reserve Board of Governor member Daniel Tarullo resigned last week, effective the 5th of April, which is going to leave President Trump with three openings to fill on the seven-member board. Two were holdovers from the Obama era. Thing is that Tarullo was the point man on bank regulation after the financial crisis, and his resignation is going to give Trump an opportunity to move faster on his deregulatory agenda. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra gets us going with what that's going to mean.
One of President Trump's priorities is loosening regulations on banks. That's something over which the Fed has a good deal of control. Robert Hartwig teaches finance at the University of South Carolina.
The Fed is, in effect, the ultimate policeman when it comes to the nation's banks. It is the entity that decides who gets bailed out, who gets designated as the riskiest financial institutions in the country.
Sarah Binder, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, says Trump will likely fill the Fed board with people who want to roll back financial regulation, and that those appointees may not be the academics or macroeconomist types who've governed the Fed for years.
This is not a president who's prioritizing academic knowledge or expertise.
She points to decisions Trump has made, like appointing former Goldman Sachs president Gary Cohn as a key economic advisor and declining to include the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, an economist, in his cabinet. Mark Grant from Hilltop Securities says Trump values the private sector perspective, and we should expect to see that reflected in his Fed appointments.
My belief that Mr. Trump is going to appoint business people to the Fed and that the Fed is going to be run and governed in a very different fashion than it is currently.
These probably won't be Trump's last appointments to the Federal Reserve. Fed Chair Janet Yellen's term is up in less than a year. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
House Republicans, as you might know, are mulling an overhaul to the tax code, one version of which would have businesses that import stuff pay higher taxes on those goods by as much as 20%. Exporters, meanwhile, would have the money they make off those exports exempt from taxes. Domestic manufacturers are in favor. Not surprisingly, retailers that import stuff are not. So a bunch of big retail CEOs are going to Congress this week to weigh in. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more now on the winners and losers of what's being called a border adjustment tax.
Retail industry executives have been trekking to Washington and raising the alarm. They rely on imports to bring in clothes and electronics and say the proposed border adjustment tax could ruin them. Steve Rosenthal is an economist at the Tax Policy Center.
Tax reform often has winners and losers. And the winners often are uncertain about how much they're going to win and are quiet or sidelined. But the losers, they get pretty vocal.
Rosenthal says, in theory, losses could be offset by a stronger dollar. Plus, the GOP plan also includes tax rate cuts for businesses. But David French of the National Retail Federation doubts that would be enough to offset a 20% tax. He's with an alliance trying to convince Congress to drop the idea. He says for businesses that rely on imports,
they can go out of business. They can raise their prices enough to pay the tax. Or they can close operations and try to cut overhead.
Manufacturers are on the other side of the argument. Brian Reardon is an advisor with the American Made Coalition, which includes manufacturers like GE and Eli Lilly.
The challenge we face right now is that the tax code is biased against producing products and creating jobs here in the United States, and it favors importing products from other countries.
He says a border adjustment tax would balance out that disparity, which is why he, too, was up on the Hill this week, lobbying lawmakers to move ahead with the plan. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Toshiba, a fixture of Japan Inc. for more than a century, is in some big trouble, $6.3 billion worth. The company announced that loss after the close in Tokyo today and then said the numbers could get worse, which in turn spawned whispers that Toshiba might not survive in its current form. It is, as they say, complicated, but at the center of it all is the company's big bet on nuclear power in the United States that went bad. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has that one.
Historically a maker of TVs and elevators and computer chips, Toshiba bought the American firm Westinghouse a decade back. Westinghouse owned a next-generation nuclear reactor design, but it turned out to be a whopping financial meltdown. Pernilla Rudland consults to Japanese companies.
There is a tendency perhaps for Japanese companies to overpay, especially for big trophy names like Westinghouse. Toshiba is a very, very proud Japanese company. They just seem to have a real reluctance to kind of admit that mistakes were made.
It began with Westinghouse building nuclear plants in Georgia and South Carolina. They're now years overdue and billions over budget. This is complicated new technology being installed by contractors in over their heads, says Michael Schellenberger of Environmental Progress, a pro-nuclear policy group.
There was just no experience building nuclear power plants in general. I mean, it had just been decades since we had been ordering and building new plants.
At the center of the storm is the shoddy work of contracting firm Stone and Webster, which Westinghouse recently acquired. But losing $6 billion? Jonathan Hinsey is with the nuclear energy firm UX Consulting.
They bought Stone Webster for a little under $300 million, but now they're on the hook for over $6 billion. So there's something there that doesn't seem right to me.
Toshiba says a whistleblower has been talking about possible accounting irregularities. Wherever this goes, Toshiba is in survival mode. It's now trying to sell off its flash memory division, the corporate crown jewel. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, records all over the place. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tuesday, which means another episode of our Marketplace podcast, Make Me Smart, drops. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, and me on the events of the day and your questions about those events. Some other stuff, too, but right now it is the questions bit that we're interested in. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, you get to explain. Go.
All right, we're going to do a lightning round of questions.
Yes.
Because we have gotten so many. So some of the ones you've sent in on Twitter and Facebook and our website and emails, Kai and I will have 30 seconds or less to answer them. I don't know what he's going to ask me. He doesn't know what I'm going to ask him. But we do know that if we go longer than 30 seconds, there's apparently going to be a buzzer.
We also get one pass if we want to use it. Obviously, no phoning a friend.
We do phone a friend from on the podcast sometimes, as you will hear in this week's episode dropping later today. But that is a whole other thing.
Hold everything. All right. We're going to start. I'm asking the first question. I guess we start the timer. It goes
right.
Like this. Jeffrey Muir Perkins wrote, and this is a paraphrase. He said, should Twitter integrate a dislike button? And what might that mean for what happens on there? And what is Twitter's duty to recognize its effect on the democratic process?
You know, YouTube has the thumbs down button, and Facebook, I know, has experimented with it and decided that it would be too negative. But let's be honest, Twitter's already really negative anyway. So if you could use the dislike button to downvote, I think I might be in favor.
I think I agree with that. All right, your turn. Go.
All right. John Lindsay Blue on Facebook during our Facebook live chat yesterday said, and this is kind of a big one, is Econ 101 still even relevant in the USA administration?
In 30 seconds, ready, go. So here's the interesting part about the Trump administration and economics 101. There are no academic economists on staff, save for one person, Peter Navarro, who runs the National Economic Council. But the Council of Economic Advisors, which is the president's and the White House's in-house academic advisory shop on economics, has been downgraded out of the cabinet. There is no chairman named yet. So I think right now it's more policy versus effects of the policy. Oh, man, that's a rude noise. Wow. Okay. That was 30. All right. I stopped.
Yep,
I stopped.
He's done.
Wow. She's not messing around. She being our producer, Bridget Bonner. All right. Here comes another question to you. You ready?
Yep.
Ooh, this one's hard. Raycel Augustin Martinez Sanchez says, can you explain how tech people can help us counter fake news?
Oh, my goodness. Well, look, there are algorithms for this, and I think that Facebook and Google in particular are trying to roll them out. What they would essentially do is look at some of the things that make search more reliable, right? Like Google says, look, a site is reliable enough to be in my search results, if it is frequently cited, if it's a domain that's been registered for a long time, if it has names that we recognize in it. There are technology tools like that that can be used to filter out information. The only problem is that once you start filtering information, it can become a slippery slope.
Which we've talked about before.
That's all I had to say.
There you go. That's
slippery slope.
Okay. Do we have to? We'll squeeze one more in. You ask me. Go.
This is also kind of a hard one, but interesting. Jack Daniel on Twitter says, had we not bailed out the car companies, what would the electric vehicle market look like?
Wow, that's really interesting. How many layers are there to that question?
I know.
Arguably, it would be less far along because the car companies are quite healthy now, and they are willing to make the investment in things like the Chevy Bolt and the Chevy Volt and all of those. Set aside Tesla here for a second because that's not a mainline car company. So I think had the car companies been allowed to go under, it would have actually set back the large-scale manufacturing of electric vehicles, and people can write in and yell at me if they disagree with that. I'm using all my time. Oh, no. Oh, God. All right, we're done. We got to go.
I agree, though.
Make Me Smart is the podcast. Me and Molly Wood. No buzzers, though. Bye.
Bye.
Rochester, Minnesota is the home of the world-renowned Mayo Clinic. The city and the hospital have been virtually synonymous for more than a century, but now a massive economic development project backed by Mayo and the city and the state is trying to transform Rochester, a city of about 110,000 people. From Minnesota Public Radio, Catherine Richard reports.
Looking out the window from the top of the Mayo Biobusiness Center in downtown Rochester, all Jim Rogers can see is change.
I can count. Just about every building has a new business, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years, it seems.
Rogers, who's chair of business development for Mayo, says change is happening inside the clinic walls, too. Mayo has lifted policies that blocked employees from owning or holding an executive position with a medical company, and a business accelerator helps employees develop new products. The idea is to turn the region into the Silicon Valley of medicine.
It's incredible what's occurring down here.
Rogers points to a couple of examples, a health record system for the intensive care unit and a less invasive procedure to treat carpal tunnel syndrome, both products of Mayo's efforts to support innovation. In the Rochester of the future, Rogers says more products like these will be developed in Discovery Square, a downtown tech park where the idea is for Mayo employees, startups, and major medical firms to collaborate.
Gone, hopefully, are the days where a company comes, wants to talk to a few physicians, thinks they got a good idea, and they run off and develop a product that, at the end of the day, doesn't meet the patient need or the physician need. And gone are the days, I hope, where we think, well, we should just be able to do it ourselves. It needs to be partnership.
Discovery Square is part of a 20-year economic development effort to remake Rochester so Mayo can better compete for patients and top talent. The state, city, and Mayo, as well as other private investors, will all be contributing money, totaling about $6.5 billion over the life of the project. The project is also meant to help diversify Southeast Minnesota's economy beyond healthcare. Right now, Mayo is the state's largest employer, with more than 30,000 people in the region on its payroll. But to build its reputation as something more than a medical hub, some say Rochester's culture needs to change. Jamie Sunsbach manages a co-working space for startups in Rochester's downtown.
When you have a large medical institution like the Mayo Clinic, a world-renowned top medical institution in the world, you get that way by basically eliminating risk. And if you look at some of the entrepreneurial communities, risk is really what they're excited about.
Michael Gorman is managing director with venture capital firm Split Rock Partners in the Twin Cities area. He says Mayo's ambition to make Rochester a magnet for innovation has great potential. But Gorman says a robust workforce is also critical.
One of the questions any entrepreneur, let alone an investor, asks is this company located in a spot where we are actually able to scale and grow the business?
As Rochester moves beyond medicine, Gorman says the city will be in tough competition for tech-savvy professionals. And Rochester already has a shortage of those workers.
There's certainly a talent gap. It's like a Grand Canyon.
Mike Rowley founded Rochester's Go Route. The company's technology allows football coaches to communicate with players from the sidelines during practice. This year, Rowley says he's ready to ramp up sales and needs more skilled workers. But finding them is proving difficult, and he's worried his backers will pressure him to move to cities in nearby Wisconsin or Illinois.
We want you to come to the cities, or we want you to come to Chicago, or we want you to go to Madison, where you've got a ready and willing workforce because you've got a young workforce, and you've got ready and a willing talent that you don't have to fight Mayo for.
If Go Route thrives in Rochester, it could help alter the city's fortunes. Venture capitalist Michael Gorman says Rochester needs just a few success stories to become the magnet for innovators that it wants to be. In Rochester, I'm Catherine Richard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, the idea was give fishermen a stake in the ocean and they'll become conservationists.
Nice idea had it worked out that way. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 92 points today, 0.4%, 20,504. The NASDAQ up 18 points, 0.3%, 5782. The S&P 500 climbed 9 points, 0.4%, 23.37. We mentioned the border tax a little bit earlier. Tomorrow, the CEOs of Target, Best Buy, and Gap are among a group of 8 retail bosses who are going to be in Washington to meet with Congress. Target gained 0.1% today. Best Buy up 3%. The Gap up 2.4% today. Amazon, it turns out, is now getting into the video teleconferencing market, going head-to-head with Microsoft's Skype Chime, it's called. Traders couldn't have cared less. Amazon barely moved. Microsoft dialed in about 0.3% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.46%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. New York Fashion Week is in full swing right now, which means it is go time for the Anna Wintours of the world and at least a couple of people with the last name Jenner. Thing is, though, that as with much of the rest of the economy, fashion is changing right now and changing fast. Kate Betts is our go-to for questions of fashion and style. Kate, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
I'm going to start with a sacrilegious question. You ready? Given social media and all the other ways that designers have to get their message, their word, their vision out, do the runways even matter anymore?
For some people, they do still matter. There's a lot of change going on in the fashion business, probably more behind the scenes than actually presenting on the runway. And so there are a lot of brands and designers who do still need the runway to get the message out. Calvin Klein, huge $8 billion business, has a brand new designer everybody's excited about, Raf Simons. They need to do a runway show.
But they still need the social media influencers, right? I mean, you got to get the person with, you know, 15 million Instagram followers to get you out there.
Exactly. And those are the people that are having more and more influence and power in the market.
Right.
They are taking over where traditional publishing and advertising left off.
Let's get to the corporate side of this thing. You mentioned Raf Simons at Calvin Klein. The CEO of Ralph Lauren is recently out. There's shaking up going on in the top ranks of some of the big houses.
Yeah, a lot of shaking up. We always talk about, you know, when is the old guard going to step aside
right.
and the new guard going to take over. And I think what this boils down to and what's really interesting from a market point of view is that the fashion market now is one market. It is not contemporary versus high-end versus, you know, the Gap. So how do you adapt to that? You know, I think it's interesting that the CEO of Ralph Lauren, who recently left, came from the Gap and H&M. And
right. But,
so
but
maybe,
it didn't do him any good, right?
Right. I mean, maybe the adaptation is too difficult to make it in one fell swoop like that. You know, they're big businesses, $8 billion business for Calvin Klein. That's a big ship to suddenly turn. So it's going to take a while.
Let me turn this to a little bit of politics, but mostly business. Were you at all surprised that Nordstrom said it was done with Ivanka Trump based on product and quality and sales figures?
Actually, I wasn't surprised, and I'll tell you why, because I know that most people think it was a political move, mm-hmm. but the product wasn't strong enough. Her sales were down by nearly a third at Nordstrom, and you know, that's the retail situation these days. If you are down by a third, you're not going to last at that retail mm-hmm. outlet.
Kate Betts, she writes on fashion and style. You see her on television. Her most recent book is called My Paris Dream. Kate, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
A word now about food, seafood to be precise. It is very big business, but there are only so many fish in the sea, you know, which is an economic problem and an environmental challenge as well. Lee Vandervoo writes about it in her new book. It is called The Fish Market. Lee, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me the story, would you, of how this book came to be?
Sure. I had just written a story about seafood and was in a bar with a bunch of writers loudly complaining about how I was never going to do it again. Somebody heard me and bet me on the spot one beer that they could get me to do it. And they started telling me about a new policy push to make seafood more sustainable in America and how it was starting to have some really significant downstream consequences for coastal communities and people who fish.
Long story short, you lost the beer, right?
I lost that bet, yeah. It was worth it.
Do me a favor, would you, and define a term for me, because it's kind of at the root of this whole book, this idea of catch share.
Sure. The U.S. enforces limits on how many fish can come out of the water, and they do it to make sure that the fish that come out in any given year can be there again next year or in 20 years. A catch share is a means of enforcing that cap. And what it is to take the pie of all the fish that can be caught in a given year, if you will, and slicing it up and giving the pieces away in ownership to individuals and corporations that qualify.
So I could, you know, if in theory I could buy into this market, I could buy the rights to 250,000 pounds of pollock or whatever it is.
If you got a deep enough pocket, you can.
Right. The problem, though, at least as I gather from your book, is that these rights then become privatized. What was supposed to be a communal health of the ocean thing has become an economic device.
Yeah, indeed it has. You know, the idea was give fishermen a stake in the ocean and they'll become conservationists, but it was a bit of a gamble. It was like giving 100 people houses and betting everybody's going to cut their grass. You just don't really know. And the effect has been kind of mixed. Some people became the good stewards that conservationists envisioned when they pushed this policy in America, and a lot of people just became landlords.
This transition to catch shares, has it been transparent to the consumer? I mean, you know, 30 years ago, if I went to the freezer aisle and got some fish sticks, is it a different experience for me today? It's basically the same deal, right? No?
I don't know that the transition has been terribly transparent. I think that there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, fishermen leading better lives and being more deeply rewarded for the work that they do. And I think that that's true for people who became inheritors of the resource. The ones that are still out there fishing, they definitely do get paid better. They're safer because the industry has slowed down through this method of pre-assigning who gets to catch what. And it definitely is ecologically cleaner to pre-assign the catch. But the private property piece, that's the piece that nobody talks about. I mean, in any other natural resource industry in America, say timber or mining, we do this through leasing. We don't do it by giving people ownership over the resource. And it's that ownership that is creating these downstream consequences for so many people. You know, it used to be that if you were a fisherman and you wanted to grow in your industry, you know, you just get better at it and you would over time be able to afford your own boat, afford your own equipment, afford the licenses to go fishing. Now you got to own, you have to be able to afford the access to the ocean, which is tremendously expensive. So, you know, the next logical inheritor of the resource is no longer the fishermen. It's investors, it's corporations, it's entities that are moving the economic benefits of fishing further and further away from coastal towns.
Great line in the acknowledgments, which, to be fair, you credit to Rick Lyman at the New York Times. People don't care about fish or fishing. They care about seafood. That's kind of what underlies this whole thing, right?
Yes, indeed. People care about what they eat, maybe not so much about the person that brings it to them.
But maybe they should. You know, this is a pretty significant trend here in this nation. And we've seen a lot in the last election, people talk an awful lot about what has happened to workers in the heartland. We're not really talking about what's happening to workers in coastal communities. And right now, that halibut that's costing $28, $30 a pound in the Whole Foods case, the guy that goes and catches that is paying up to 75% of the revenue of that trip to a landlord. That's a problem.
It's a book called The Fish Market by Lee Vandervoort. Lee, thanks very much.
Thank you for your time.
This final note on the way out today, which I must tell you in advance, I do kind of love. The Atlanta Zoo lost a Super Bowl bet with a zoo up in New England. Naming a baby animal after the winning team starting quarterback was the payoff. So today, after the Pats' crazy comeback, Zoo Atlanta introduced the newest addition to its family, Tom Brady, a Madagascar hissing cockroach. Now I'm going to get hate mail from Pats fans, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow up 92 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ gained 18 points, 0.3%. S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.4%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our Special Projects desk. Caitlin Ash is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.